Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Bananas today. Big blue skulls, big blue skulls, big blue skulls. Let's make it a blue evil.
Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where today we're talking about the Peter Sellers episode of The Muppet Show, which broadcast 45 years ago on February 24th, 1978 in the United States, after its production date of December 6th, 1977. Singular.
Yeah, wild.
The 19th production episode of the second season. So it seems as if maybe they didn't have a lot of access to Peter Sellers.
There's something else that's wild. I cheated a bit and was looking ahead at what's coming up. And there's another episode that also has a December 6th production date. But I'm starting to wonder, based off of everything that we've talked about this season, about the weirdness of things being recorded out of order and put in order and whatnot, if these production dates are purely the days they had guest stars. Like, those 3 days were the guest star days, and the rest of it was just like, okay, we'll just do it whenever and plug them in.
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible that based on production reality, and the second half of the season started producing elements of the show that could be plug and play on other times, and that those dates aren't reflected in the fandom's production diary in terms of what dates things were done.
Yeah. Also, and we'll get into this shortly, it's hard to believe that Peter Sellers was only one day on this, because A, we've talked about, you know, recording days, you know, pre-taping the music, all that stuff. His segments are not easy. They seem very well rehearsed, and also they're not the simplest of things. They're not complicated either, but they're involved.
And if there was pre-recording, if there was anything that involved complication, to have done that on faith that we'd be able to get it right in one day of production, when one can basically assume that the very act of filming with Muppets is a technically complicated enough process that those are not short days, and that you can't just get straight to filming.
Yeah.
You can't just slap a costume on your guest star and then just be ready to roll without a lot of hurry up and wait in terms of getting things ready.
And considering this episode has a fair amount of special effects and camera trickery, that's going to slow things down too, because it's not just, oh, we'll just get it in one.
I didn't even think about that, because I was immediately going to say, well, there's not that much camera trickery with the guest star, but that is a lie.
Yeah, absolutely a lie.
Well, speaking of the guest star, maybe we should get to the trivia about the guest star so we can then talk about his segments in the context of the whole show.
Sounds good to me.
I'm going to ask Pete 4 questions about the life and career of Peter Sellers, mostly sourced from Alexander Walker's 1981 authorized biography. And then I'm going to talk to him about Peter Sellers' top 4 best known for on IMDb roles. And we're going to see how this all shakes out. Question number 1. Peter Sellers was born to Peg and Bill Sellers on September 8, 1925. Bill had been a pianist recruited to accompany an act where Peg and other performers did a traveling vaudeville swimming display in a giant tank, where they could be seen underwater by the audience in order to better show off their clinging forms and bathing costumes. However, this show business ancestry was not the forebear that Sellers most revered. According to the first chapter of Walker's biography, a portrait of which ancestor always hung in either Sellers' office or home? A. Great Uncle Benjamin Disraeli, Prime Minister of England from 1874 to 1880 before his death in 1881. Sellers is a direct descendant of his cousin, the Earl of Beaconfield, whose name and lineage he would sometimes adopt when checking into hotels. B. Daniel Mendoza, the heavyweight champion of England in 1785 and Sellers' great-great-grandfather, a Portuguese Jew and enormous role model for the English Jewish community. UK theater critic Kenneth Tynan linked Sellers' determination to be respected in show business to this legacy. Or C. Welcome Ray, Peter's grandmother, had a brother, Emmanuel, born in 1890, who became famous as the groundbreaking surrealist photography Man Ray, who is known for his frequent collaborations with Salvador Dali. It's widely believed but unproven that a recorded childhood visit of Sellers with his uncle and their artistic collaborators in Paris was the gestalt source for his Inspector Clouseau impression. One of those is true.
Out of respect for Improv Boston, I am going to guess C, since the Man Ray Club is now occupying the Improv Boston Theater space.
While Sellers' grandmother was known as Ma Ray, this was a stage name that she adopted. Her married name was Marks. The correct answer is B, Daniel Mendoza. Question number two. Peter Sellers began performing as a ukulele player and drummer for itinerant bands at age 16, having been pulled out of school at age 14 by his mother to help with the family finances. He began developing impressions of film stars to impress girls and got a reputation as a mimic. Upon beginning his serious showbiz career, what experience most shaped his early goals as a performer? A. Impersonating a well-known theatrical agent, Sellers pretended to be BBC radio sitcom producer Roy Spear in order to get an audition to perform in a music hall variety show, recommending himself as an impressionist and then dropping the act to prove that he could, in fact, do impressions. This led to a solid variety show grounding that helped populate his broad base of characters of musicians, stage magicians, sword swallowers, and others that he'd used throughout his career. B. While trying to capitalize on the early success of the BBC radio program The Goon Show in 1952, Sellers, Harry Secombe, and Spike Milligan took unauthorized versions of their radio characters to the Coventry Hippodrome and found the live audience of older patrons totally unmoved by their antics. Spike Milligan was so disillusioned by this, he almost killed himself, and Sellers vowed to only perform on film and radio thereafter in order to avoid the, quote, hatefulness, unquote, of live audiences. Or C, in working with Alec Guinness in 1955 in The Lady Killers, Guinness was a great inspiration for Sellers, having played multiple characters in the 1949 dark healing comedy Kind Hearts and Coronets. Guinness gave the following advice. All actors fear auditions and having to put yourself out there and to always have your heart on your sleeve. He said, if you can find a repertory company or a long-running series that generates work and doesn't require you to re-audition, stick with it. This is the reason people believe that Sellers was so jealously clinging to the role of the Pink Panther, and despite having multiple fights with director Blake Edwards, went back to the franchise again and again. One of those is true. C. Unfortunately, it was the live performance and hatred of audiences.
I almost get beat again.
Guinness, in fact, said the exact opposite, advising him never play the same kind of role twice. Question number three. Sellers lived in England in 1977 during the filming of The Muppet Show, so it likely wasn't any great difficulty for him to get to Elstree Studios and film. However, his once prominent star had fallen. Most of Sellers' critical hits were produced between 1960 and 1969. Lolita and Strangelove were in 62 and 64. The Pink Panther and A Shot in the Dark were in 63 and 64. And the Bond spoof Casino Royale was in 67. In fact, that film was a legendary debacle and predicated a series of future failures on the part of Sellers. By 1973, he had made three films that were never released theatrically. The Black House, A Day at the Beach, and The Ghost of the Noonday Sun. So what project produced by Sir Lou Grade, producer of The Muppet Show, may have established the connection that allowed him to be on the show despite being in a bit of a slump in 77? In chronological order, A, in 1975, in order to pay off the dissolution of his third marriage, Sellers signed a contract with Grade to make a 26-episode sitcom for ITV called The Return of the Pink Panther. This eventually was turned into the film of the same title. B, in 1976, Sellers was in talks with Grade to make a TV movie of The Man in the Iron Mask, based on the success of Richard Lester's adaptation of The Three Musketeers in 75. When it was discovered that Lester, who had previously directed the Beatles films and collaborated with Sellers and Milligan on the Running, Jumping, and Standing Still film, was not going to be with the project, Sellers left. C. Sellers was in talks with Grade in 1977 to be part of the Grade-produced adaptation of the Ira Levin Hitler clone suspense novel The Boys from Brazil. Sellers wanted it to be a multiple-part clone comedy, much like what eventually became the Michael Keaton vehicle Multiplicity, and he did The Muppet Show as a sign of good faith. Eventually, however, creative differences led to the project being done in its original darker roots like the novel.
A.
That's correct. Question number four. In dialogue in this episode, Sellers says, "There used to be a me, but I had it surgically removed." That dialogue, along with an introduction that Brian Henson made on the Time Life Best of the Muppet Show DVDs, is oft repeated and used to claim that Sellers stipulated that he'd only appear on the show if he never had to be himself out of character, because, as Brian Henson tells it, he told the writers, quote, "I can't be myself." This anecdote is not specifically confirmed any place else, but what other biographical detail might have been evidence that this story is true? Two of these are correct. Identify the lie. A. In Alexander Walker's biography, he says that after Sellers' meeting with Guinness, who was profiled as a chameleon or a faceless actor who could disappear into roles, Sellers began cultivating a persona where he would be more alive in the role than as himself, and as soon as 1959's I'm All Right, Jack, he was claiming, quote, "the real Peter Sellers doesn't exist," unquote. B. Roger Lewis's 2000 unauthorized biography of Sellers, The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, and, to some extent, the 2004 Jeffrey Rush film based on it, claims, quote, "that Peter Sellers was evil," unquote, and utterly lacking in a real personality of his own, hiding behind impressions, fantastic displays of theatrical rage or affection, and frequently cutting family, friends, and longtime business associates out of his life. Or C. In the 2018 memoir by second wife Britt Eklund, entitled True Brit, she claimed that Sellers was an undiagnosed sociopath, actually completely unable to convey real emotion, but so skilled at mimicry that he was able to hide this fact. She said, when their child was born, he was totally baffled by her, and relates a key anecdote that he had no idea what to do when she was crying. She became scared for her daughter's life and hastened the end of the relationship. She told that story in 2018 in conjunction with the Me Too movement, but the British conservative press claimed her accounts were overblown and were not medically sourced.
I
don't want C to be true, so I'm going to go with C.
Correct. The difference between Sellers being genuinely weird about his lack of personality and having it be the end result of cultivating a theatrical performance, it's very different in those two biographies in terms of the accusatorial tone that the biographers use about it. The Lewis biography is aggressive, whereas the Walker biography is written by somebody who knew, corresponded with, and liked Sellers. And so while he's critical of Sellers, he's not willing to go that far to say he's a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
The Eklund biography, True Brit, was written in 1980, either shortly before or shortly after Sellers' death. While she talks about their marriage in strained terms, none of those imaginary diagnoses are real. As always, my fifth question is 6 degrees of Jim Henson or the Henson Connection, where I read out Peter Sellers' top four best known for on IMDb and some of the key cast members in those. Pete then has 60 seconds to connect those cast members to Jim Henson using classic 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon techniques, and if so, he gets a point. Peter Sellers, best known for on IMDb, are 1979's Being There with Shirley MacLaine, Jack Warden, and, weirdly enough, Fran Brill, who, despite being Mary Louise on The Muppet Show, has only 8 feature film credits on IMDb, Midnight Run, What About Bob, Doug's First Movie, and Elmo in Grouchland, which was filmed after Jim Henson's death. So she has no theatrical connections to Henson at all. I'm just telling you that right off the top.
I mean, What About Bob? I gotta be able to get there from...
I'm just saying.
I can't just go Fran Brill to Jim Henson.
Correct.
Understood. Now I understand.
Unsurprisingly, his entry in the AFI Top 100, Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb from 1964, which has in it Stanley Hayden, George C. Scott, Slim Pickens, and the film premiere of a person that is so obvious if I say it, I'm not going to tell you unless you can't come up with anything better.
Rude.
The Return of the Pink Panther from 1975. Featuring Herbert Lom, Burt Kwok, Christopher Plummer, and Catherine Schell. And The Pink Panther Strikes Again from 1976, also featuring Herbert Lom and Burt Kwok, but also featuring Leslie Ann Downs and Richard Vernon. Using any of those cast members, or anybody else from those four movies that you can come up with, can you connect Peter Sellers to Jim Henson in 60 seconds, starting now?
Christopher Plummer is not the person I'm thinking of.
He is the person.
No, he is, but he is not, because I was trying to go through Lord of the Rings.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he's not.
He's not.
Either of those two old men.
He's not Christopher Lee.
No. Okay, so I gotta go back. Being There.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna try to use Fran Brill because I don't remember any of the other people.
Okay.
30
seconds. What About Bob?
Yep, What About Bob? So we got Bill Murray. That should be easy. Bill Murray to Ghostbusters. We've done that before, I feel like.
No, we haven't.
We haven't? Okay.
10 seconds. Pete?
Yeah.
The mystery person of Dr. Strangelove is James Earl Jones.
Star Wars. Frank Oz. Done.
Yes, James Earl Jones had his film debut in Doctor Strangelove. So congratulations, you got the gimme point. Christopher Plummer is Harlan Thrombey in Knives Out.
Right, with Frank Oz. Yeah, of course.
Jack Warden in Being There plays the newspaper editor that Fozzie and Kermit work for in The Great Muppet Caper.
Oh, okay.
And Shirley MacLaine was in The Children's Hour with Audrey Hepburn, who connects to Through Sherrod.
Yeah, all I would have gone is Sherrod and then hoped you gave it to me. But I also wouldn't have known that Audrey Hepburn
connects to James Coburn, who's in the Muppet movie. So, if you hadn't said James Coburn, I wouldn't have given
it. Yeah, I definitely wouldn't have said James Coburn.
You could have also done Shirley MacLaine is in the Children's Hour with, why do I always forget his name, with, see, I can also fail at this game. James Garner, who's in The Great Escape with James Coburn, who's in the Muppet movie. The other major connection is that Herbert Lom, who plays Inspector Dreyfus in the Pink Panther movies, is in The Lady Killers with Alec Guinness.
Mm.
So there actually were a surprising number of pretty good connections if you can make that first leap.
Which I'm unable to.
It's important to underscore the weirdness of the disassociation of Peter Sellers before we talk about his segments, because it is true that it's easy to believe in Brian Henson's anecdote that Sellers refused to play himself in this episode. Because while there are backstage segments with Kermit talking to him and calling him Peter, he does not use his real voice. He uses a plummy, aristocratic British accent that's not how he normally talks. And he never is completely out of costume. He's always doing something where he's wearing the remnants of playing a part.
The closest thing I was thinking about it was in the closing when he bloops into existence just in a suit. And he basically says,
"Thank you very much indeed."
But he is still wearing a German war helmet.
No, that's when he bloops out of existence and bloops back into existence and does the character. So I thought maybe
that one line
could have potentially been him. Or maybe his real voice was in the talk spot just briefly.
Mm.
But yeah, otherwise I was like, oh yeah, he's committing. I have no evidence. And I didn't even know that was a thing until you read it in the trivia. So wild speculation on my part.
The film that I mentioned that was one of the three that was never released, filmed in 1973, The Ghost of the Noonday Sun. There's a recent documentary that was put out about all the things that went wrong on that film and why the director felt that Sellers in 1973 was deliberately sabotaging the conclusion of the filming of that film. That he was so wrapped up in his neuroses about his performance that he was doing things in order to make the film unfilmable, so that it wasn't his fault when it went bad.
Mm.
But you definitely get footage of Sellers in unguarded moments in that film. And so I think that I have an awareness based on that, based on his work in the Kubrick films, as to what his voice is probably closer to being in real life. And it's not the "I was just playing Queen Victoria" voice that he uses with Kermit.
Mm-hmm. I did see the Peter Sellers movie that you referenced in the trivia.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely rented that from Cinema 93. No memory of the movie itself.
My main memory of it is Jeffrey Rush doing a pretty good job of looking like late period Peter Sellers and occasionally playing other people. So he would play, even though they had cast somebody as Blake Edwards, there would be one scene where Rush would then play Blake Edwards talking to Peter Sellers. And that it leaned heavily on that idea of Sellers' disassociation and always mimicking other people, including the people he was working with.
Yeah, he's a wild dude.
But what I'm interested in is, because we don't have what would generally be considered to be genuine moments between the guest star and the Muppets, I will be curious, as always, to see what your rating is at the end of this episode. So in order to do that, we need to actually talk about the segments. So let's delve into right at the very beginning with Peter Sellers playing a character in his first moments on screen.
Yeah, Scooter knocks on the door and says what we're now used to, 15 seconds. based off of our conversation a couple weeks ago, the photo on the dressing room wall is Lincoln Piggy from on the set of Pigs in Space. Scooter is shocked to find Gonzo in Peter's dressing room. Gonzo's holding a knife, looking in a mirror, throwing knives at Peter, who is dressed as Inspector Clouseau, as we talked about, with knives surrounding his outline. Peter says, 15 seconds, I should live so long, and he ducks just as the knife lands where his head would have been.
And we have, in the last two episodes, I believe, talked about the fact that the performers, by acknowledging that, you know, I'll be ready, they're very close to saying,
thank you, 15.
But Peter Sellers actually says 15 seconds.
Yep.
Or, I'm sorry, Inspector Clouseau actually says 15 seconds.
They cut to the curtain at 18 seconds, and it was said 4 seconds in, so they were only off by 1 second. So, based off my plus or minus one theory, it's acceptable. I also really liked the way they did the knife.
Mm.
I noticed that on the rewatch because...
Speaking of special effects.
Yeah. There's like a bad strip of paint right behind his head. And you can tell if you really slow it down that the knife just pops out of that. That was really good. I liked that a lot.
Kermit then says the name of the guest star and we have the opening segments. In this, we have a twist on what has started to become a bit of a runner itself, of Statler and Waldorf singing along to the opening theme, but instead we have Statler coughing multiple times to the theme and then ending with Waldorf sniffing the final bit.
I wouldn't want to be sitting next to them
yes.
or near them, but through my screen, loved it. As I've said before, anything to the rhythm is immediately going to be a step up in my book. And then Gonzo is nearly blown out of the O when a beautiful day monster appears behind him with a tuba and plays the note instead of Gonzo.
Thief.
And Gonzo then looks back and says, thief.
Thief?
According to the captions.
Ah, I don't believe that was on my captions, which I did have on for large portions of this episode and which we'll come back to very soon. In front of the curtain, Kermit says, tonight's guest star is one of the great film stars of the world and is the epitome of the witty, urbane Englishman. Which are strong words.
Yeah.
But also, as I mentioned, no indication given to the idea that one of the great film stars of the world might be in a bit of a slump. Although he had just made the second two Pink Panther movies, and so he was back in clover financially because they were very successful. Mm-hmm. But it was still the opposite of what he had been trying to do prior to that point in his life, which was have as many different roles as possible.
Mm-hmm.
He was now stuck with being funny, which is the thing that consumed him, fear and worry about, is this actually good? Is this actually funny? He at least had box office receipts and laughter to make him feel like what he was doing was worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a fundamental departure from the principles he'd been trying to maintain.
Yeah, it's what you told me about he didn't want to perform in front of audiences.
Yeah.
Is truly wild because if you're, like, I get it as a semi-professional comedian. So when you perform in front of a dead audience, it is not fun.
Mm-hmm.
But also, that's at least immediate feedback where if you're in movies and you're like, I don't know how this is going to work. You're in a dead zone. And if audiences go see it, great. But if they don't, then that also feels bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's just delayed badness.
Walker tells a story about his first major film that he was in. He was really shaken by the fact that when he was performing, the crew had been trained not to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wasn't getting feedback until a scene was over, which then caused him to be on an emotional roller coaster of not trusting what he was doing until cut was called. So his relationship with his audience, from what I read of Walker's biography, continued to just be a source of internal paranoia.
Mm. That's wild to me.
We cut straight to the first segment with the guest, and he is surrounded by Muppets who are both ogling at him and catcalling him. So he's involved in a feedback loop.
Guess what?
Yeah?
This is one of our Disney Plus content warning episodes.
Well, I'm not entirely surprised because this song is called gypsy violin. And in general, that first word is not encouraged to be used in any circumstance these days. It is, I personally don't know whether or not it qualifies as a slur.
It does.
Okay. But it definitely is considered to be inaccurate and one of those classic forms of that's not what a people call themselves.
Yes. Which is why I'm confident in saying that it is a slur.
Mm. To me, a slur means it has to be used pejoratively as opposed to just inaccurately.
Well,
but I'm not an expert on this.
Yeah, based off of common phrases that use that word in it that are pejorative.
And that's definitely true that it has become a word that is only associated with negative connotations.
Yes, which is why I'm confident in saying it's a slur. So, listeners, as we use that word, it is their word, not ours.
And we're going to avoid using it as much as possible.
Yes.
But from Walker's biography, this feels like a character that he used from his very early days of show business. And he uses both the common term from the time and the word Romani in his text and says that this is actually a piece of cultural heritage from Sellers. So he would have felt comfortable doing this act as something that he felt was something he could represent, even if this depiction for comic purposes doesn't feel generous.
He's not, to use a different phrase, but trying to make a parallel, he's not doing brownface, basically, because he is of descent. So it is maybe slightly okay,
but it's still being done largely for laughs.
Which I think that's fine. You can do things for comedic effect. Mm. And I don't think this is being negative, largely. I think there are a couple of stereotypes in here, but I don't think it is belittling the Romani people.
So he is in a beaded headscarf and holding a violin and wearing a very high belt and loose trousers. And there is a wide variety of hayseed and hick Muppets spread out on the ground around him, also in approximation of garb.
Mm-hmm.
And the song is by Abe Burrows and appears on his 1950 album, Abe Burrows Sings?
Question mark being his?
Yes.
Okay.
And is one of a number of comedic songs that he put out over a couple of different albums, two apparently in 1950. He is perhaps most well known for being part of writing team for the 1961 musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Okay.
I was surprised to learn that he has no connection whatsoever to the Marx Brothers, because the first line that's delivered by the Hick Muppets on the floor after Sellers asks, "Do you have any requests?" A Muppet says,
"Yes, but you're gonna play anyway."
Which feels like Chico Marx to a T.
Mm-hmm.
The pronunciation, the faux pidgin English of it, it feels less Romani and more Italian. And then later, at the end of the sketch, you have Sellers do a Groucho Marx line.
Listen, any more talk like that and I will play.
I, however, found no connection between Burroughs and the Marx Brothers.
Well, I have a different connection for you.
Yeah.
Ben, does the name Burroughs ring a bell to you? Because Abe Burroughs is James Burroughs' father. James Burroughs being the prolific television director, specifically for you and I, of
News Radio.
Yes. So, James Burroughs comes from a parentage of comedians.
That's very interesting. Well, we can talk about very, very funny director James Burroughs' father's level of humor. The lyrics here are a series of rhymes in that Sellers says, a gypsy's heart is yearning, his blood is churning, his brain is learning, his roast is burning. And that's the basic structure of this, is that you start off with something that is florid and romantic, and then over the course of a verse of rhymes, it goes to mundane and humorous.
It's the equivalent of the UK spot from a couple weeks ago.
Mm. It's decent, solid rhyming, except the jokes aren't necessarily clever. It's not wordplay that I would associate with Gilbert and Sullivan or Sondheim, where I'm like, this is great wordplay.
Yeah. Yeah, as no longer correct as this sketch is, it is catchy, the song, and Peter really does commit to it. So
I really like the commitment that he does to the fake playing of the violin at the very end.
I wish I didn't make my Banshees of Inisherin joke last week and instead made it this week. Because that is some of the worst. That Muppet character from last week that I made fun of played better
than Peter does here.
Yes.
It is also, I'm pretty sure, live sound
it
on set.
Absolutely is.
The scraping of the bow against the seemingly untightened strings produces so little noise, but the noise it does produce seems very clearly real.
And this is my problem with it, because he says the line, "Any more talk like that and I will play."
Which is his Groucho Marx line.
Yeah, which we hear after we can hear him play poorly. And then he continues to play poorly. Like, that needed to be before that solo. But just heard you play badly. You already put us through the ringer.
It's a weird empty threat.
Because you've already tortured us. We cut to Statler and Waldorf, and Statler uses a bad word in describing that. He says, "I love some good..." He did not use Romani music.
Yes. And Waldorf says, "So?"
And then he says, "So I wish they'd play some." It follows the pattern that we've heard numerous times before, but it still works.
Backstage, all of the Anything and Hick Muppets clear out, chattering and talking, so that Kermit has to shout "quiet, quiet" over them. He says that the backstage is supposed to be quiet. And then makes a very strange joke, which is, he says to audience / himself, "Next time I'm going to schedule some peaceful Gregorian chants."
Yeah, I think that's also a comment that the monks who do Gregorian chant wouldn't be so boisterous.
I think he's saying that that's also very loud, and therefore, if you might as well have something be loud, it might as well be something pleasurably loud.
And meditative.
Yeah.
But I think he's doing another dig at the Romanis.
Then there's a vroom noise as Gonzo, in continuing the loudness, drives a motorcycle from on stage.
From that direction,
yep.
For sure.
To backstage, speeding past, yelling, yep. "Kermit, cancel my motorcycle act."
And then Kermit says, "I believe to us, the audience, this day's already been so crazy that if it keeps up, he's going to wind up talking to himself."
There is then the first of a long series of really great vreep sound effects as Bunsen teleports in behind him. And this is the major special effect that we get over the course of the episode, where you do whatever that camera trick is, where you stop filming and then you start filming again with a new person. And the work that they do in order to have Kermit be in the exact same place is almost seamless.
Yeah, I'm wondering, there was a very famous episode of Full House.
Okay.
Where Uncle Jesse had a twin who showed up, and it was the first time in an entire episode there was the same actor in the same scene.
Hmm.
And I'm wondering if they did that same trick of splitting the screen. Because we've seen them do this trick before.
Yep.
And it's been terrible. And there is no, in every single instance of this, I couldn't find jumps.
Mm.
I think only one, maybe, I saw a jump. So I'm wondering if they did multi-layers of filming a half stage, filming a half stage, and then stitching it together. Except, in the screenshot I'm seeing,
yeah,
Bunsen is...
There's physical overlap.
Yeah. So it's amazing that they were able to do this so successfully.
I wonder if, because everything was so monitor heavy on the Muppet Show, if they were able to use monitors in order to either take a picture or draw on the monitor so that they knew where the puppet had to be in order to do the splice.
Yeah, could be, because there are some busy shots and it's picture perfect.
Yeah. So Bunsen ports in and starts talking about how they have an amazing scientific breakthrough for Muppet Labs. Kermit doesn't understand that this is a teleportation thing because the word hasn't happened yet in the course of the episode, but he just instead says, don't sneak up on me like that.
And then as he continues to talk to Bunsen about not doing that, Bunsen bloops back out of existence, leaving Kermit actually talking to no one.
And then Scooter comes in and calls him on it, saying, Kermit, you're talking to yourself. And who says, thank goodness we have a nice quiet guest coming up?
Kermit transitions out of it by saying that.
And the quiet song that's coming up after that is When, again, by Abe Burrows.
Yeah. This was a weird transition, too, because Kermit runs to the stage like he's going to introduce it, but he doesn't. We just go straight to Rolf on the piano.
That's right.
It was weird.
This song is also on Abe Burrows' album, Abe Burrows Sings.
Question mark.
And both this and the Peter Sellers song are on the second Muppet Show album.
Hmm.
And in the previous album, they in fact re-recorded songs so that there were no songs sung by guest stars.
Hmm.
But on Muppet Show 2, we have a song performed by Peter Sellers on the album.
Interesting. So did they only do Muppet songs on Volume 1?
Yeah.
Okay, so because it would be hard to re-record the entire song that was performed by a human.
I can't remember off the top of my head what song was done, but there was a song that had a guest star involved in it, and they just re-recorded it without that person.
Okay.
You couldn't have done Burroughs' Serenade in that way.
Right.
But it seems like they liked that song enough. They thought they would have good sales power because of the guest star, or they had a relationship with Abe Burrows.
Yeah.
And when I first was looking at the fandom page about these three songs, it did feel like it might have been a similar relationship to the guy who wrote the wishing song with the Madeline Kahn episode or that sort of thing. But it doesn't seem to be that way. There does seem to be some sort of a professional relationship between Burrows and Henson, but not that same kind of pitching to the show.
Yeah.
It is, however, weird that there are three songs from his two albums all on this one episode. And then I believe there are two more songs from those albums that appear in future episodes. One in the next episode. I believe it's called The Sea Shanty. Will be in production episode 20 from season 2.
That is next week's episode. Spoilers.
This is a Rolf song. It starts off with Candles in Soft Focus.
Mm-hmm.
And as Kermit says, it's about being quiet.
I'm going to read my notes verbatim, Ben.
Please.
Rolf plays a silly little song. Boring but fine. End.
Statler and Waldorf. Begin with Waldorf saying,
yeah, you never know when something funny is going to happen on this show.
Did something funny happen?
Yeah.
You'd never know it.
Waldorf sounded a little off to me.
This is the second time you've said this recently.
Yeah. On the rewatch, I was trying to pay attention to it because I noticed it the first time. He sounds weird to me.
I'm not noticing it. I apologize, I can't back you up on this.
Well, I'm not telling you in advance so you can listen to it. So
it's also true. As we go backstage, Rolf crosses behind Kermit, and Kermit chastises him, saying, Rolf, that was supposed to be a nice, quiet number. And Rolf quietly doesn't respond. It's almost as if Jim Henson can't do two voices at once.
I also thought it was a quiet little number.
Mm.
Hence my comment of, it was boring, but fine.
But it's not nearly the level of noise that was generated in the first backstage segment.
And it wasn't like a rock song. It was a quiet little jazzy number, kind of. I don't know. I don't remember it. I wrote, silly little song, boring but fine.
We have a continuation of the teleportation bit. Because as Kermit finishes complaining to Rolf, Beaker whoops in, carrying a huge armload of science equipment. And when Kermit sees him and yells his name, Beaker throws the equipment up in the air.
And bloops out of existence.
I think it's two different noises. I think the appearance is more of a vwarp.
Yeah, I exclusively referred to this as blooping in my notes. But this is, again, one of those things that I think some of the stuff doesn't land. Which is why I'm wondering how they did
the stuff that Beaker threw behind him.
Yes, he throws behind him, goes away, and the stuff is still in the air. There's definitely a moment later in this episode where it is on camera the entire time and the Muppet disappears. It's not like it goes over out the top of the frame and then Chuck comes back in, which is why I'm like, how did they do this?
And then once again, because Beaker has
blooped
out, Scooter comes in and finds Kermit talking, and actually he says, Kermit, now you're shouting to yourself.
Ben?
Yeah?
This was cut from Nickelodeon.
Okay, so we have a Disney Plus cultural warning, and now we have a whole cut segment? Because why?
Don't know. Hey, Ben, buckle in. This episode was diced up on Nickelodeon.
But the previous Bunsen teleportation was not cut.
Nope.
But for some reason, most of the teleportation is gone?
Nope.
Oh, that's not the thing that they're quibbling with.
Nope. It's just random things here and there.
Okay, I won't speculate. I won't cast my mind forward in space and time in order to try and figure out. I'll let that information whoop in as necessary. We cut to the dressing room.
We bloop to the dressing room.
We don't, actually.
Yeah, you're right. I just wanted to say it.
Sorry. Sorry to know but you, but...
No, but you are right to do so.
Where we have Sellers in a corset and a Viking helmet. With a long wig and one boxing glove on.
Mm-hmm. And a floofy little shirt, undershirt.
And he's doing dialogue as Queen Victoria, saying,
"Tell John Brown, we are ready to receive him."
Kermit enters and asks Peter what he's doing. Peter says that it was supposed to be the impression of Her Late Majesty. Kermit asks what went wrong, and Peter answers that he couldn't quite remember what she looked like, referencing why he's dressed like that.
But he continues to do all this in a very Lady Bracknell voice over the whole time. Kermit says, "I just love your characters, Peter, but backstage you can relax and be yourself." And this is where the concept of Peter claiming that...
"I could never be myself."
Never yourself?
No. You see, there is no me. I do not exist.
Is given text here.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that is based on a conversation with the writers and whether that is based on a lifelong psychosis of sorts, it is interesting that they decided and he acquiesced to the idea of taking that information about himself and making it part of his character.
Mm-hmm.
It is also a little fun that he gets a little sinister about it as he leans in and looks around suspiciously that somebody might overhear what he's doing.
Yeah, that he's being honest in his dishonesty.
And Kermit naturally feels uncomfortable with this and asks if he can change the topic. It is a little dark and odd for the Muppet Show.
Yeah. Peter is happy to change the subject because he doesn't like talking about himself. He wants to show Kermit a new act he's recently perfected. He wants to show Kermit that he can recite the soliloquy from Shakespeare's Richard III whilst and at the same time playing tuned chickens.
He gestures, saying once more into the what I had on my subtitles as bridge.
Nope, it's breach.
I know the Shakespeare line is once more into the breach, but I was weirded out that the DVD people did not know that.
Disney Plus did.
Okay, good.
Tuned chickens once more into the breach.
And chickens rise up from behind the table so that he's able to squeeze them under his arms like they're the bladders of a bagpipe.
No, Ben, Hamilton rises up. We're seeing that tomorrow.
And he then does the soliloquy from Richard III, or at least segments from it, and each time he squeezes down with his arms and the chickens balk accordingly.
After he finishes, he feeds them seed and the chickens are happy to receive their payment for their performance. Kermit then tells him that it's good, but he can't do it because Gonzo did it last month.
You can't do that on our show.
Why not?
Well, because Gonzo just did it last month.
It died, Peter. It was terrible. I mean, they've got no taste around here.
And you know what, Pete?
Yeah.
We don't do negative moments on this show, but I am deeply, deeply critical here. Because Gonzo suddenly appears in this dressing room, and there is no traditional Gonzo's whoop sound effect.
Yeah, no.
It's not, I died, Peter. It's just, he comes in.
Yeah. No, I'm with you there. I didn't notice it, but I did notice that subconsciously. It wasn't there. Yeah.
He says that, and this is the first sort of return to Gonzo shtick that we've had in a long time, because he says, it was terrible. They have no taste around here. And it's very much back to Gonzo blaming the audience for not having artistic sensibilities, which is not rhetoric that he's broken out in quite some time.
But he wasn't upset about it.
No, it wasn't the same
whiny. Yeah, it was just, it didn't go well. The audience has no taste.
Yeah.
And then Gonzo bloops out of existence.
And Peter is seemingly very surprised by this, peering around, asking where did he go. And when Kermit says, that's been happening all day, so somebody appears or disappears, just try to ignore it. And then there's a close-up shot, an insert shot, of a cartoon bomb whooping in.
Kermit panically says, cancel that last remark. And as Peter stands up to exit, he says, I have a pressing appointment. And then he bloops out of existence, leaving just Kermit.
The bomb goes off, and Kermit is left in traditional good cartoon bomb effect of being blackened and sootened as he woozily closes the sketch.
Yeah.
Then there's a fade to black.
Yeah, it was an early fade to black.
It didn't feel like the halfway point.
It wasn't. It was 10 minutes and 29 seconds into the episode.
Huh. So I assumed that the next sketch that comes back, where we have the introduction in front of the curtain, that the song after that was the UK spot.
Yep.
It is?
It is.
It's just not halfway through the episode.
Nope. They went to commercial super early in this episode, I guess. Also, there was an edit in that sketch on Nickelodeon as well. Kermit's reaction to the bomb was cut from Nickelodeon. So I don't know if the bomb goes off and then they cut, but there's no him with soot, apparently.
But it's not the cancel that last remark bit that's cut. It's the...
Unlike some people around here.
According to the fandom page, yes.
Okay. I just thought it was odd that Peter seems distressed and weirded out by Gonzo disappearing, but then has the power to remove himself two lines later.
Well, we'll find out, but no one has the power to do anything. It's just happening. He is surprised.
When he says, I have a pressing engagement, and then disappears, it doesn't feel like Snagglepuss saying, exit stage left. It feels like him conjuring the ability to go.
I think he was just running and happened to get blooped.
Okay.
He was exit stage lefting either way.
Got it. So if he hadn't been blooped, he would have whoop, 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 whoop out of there.
Yeah. That's my feeling.
Okay.
But yes, as you said, once we fade back up, Kermit is introducing the UK spot, which is weird because...
You don't normally have an introduction to the UK spot because that makes it even longer as opposed to just the 2 minutes of American advertisement length.
Yep. As Kermit's introducing it, he keeps vacillating between introducing it and he stepped in gum on the stage. And so he's going back and forth between a line about what's about to happen and then trying to unstick himself from the stage. And then just as he finishes saying the name of the song, Down Memory Lane, he unsticks his foot and goes flying off stage as the curtain opens.
This is actually referred to in Joseph Bailey's Memoirs of a Muppet Writer. And he includes it in his chapter on Frank Oz. He says, early in my Sesame Street career, I was watching an Ernie and Bert piece. And as usual, Ernie had created an enormous mess in their living room. Bert entered and immediately began to complain about how messy the place was, including the floor. He pointed out several objects on it and stumbled over a few more. What clicked immediately with me is that Frank Oz was completing the illusion, because there is no floor, but Frank was subconsciously creating one in the viewer's mind. Since then, I've carried a floor around in my bag of Muppet writing tricks, and I used it in Kermit's chewing gum introduction. So... He remembers this and remembers writing this sketch specifically because he liked the ability to create the illusion of and giving the puppeteers the opportunity to react to something that's below the camera level. And when you especially think about the fact that Kermit's nether regions are just Jim's arm. Mm-hmm. Anything that he's doing as a puppeteer to give the impression of one limb sticking, if it does that successfully, if it makes it feel like there isn't just a tube of bone and flesh going down from below the camera,
yep,
but that there is the impression that one leg works and the other one doesn't, or that it's away from the center of gravity of his body, then that actually is a remarkable achievement.
Mm-hmm. Ben?
Yeah.
Nickelodeon didn't see most of this introduction. That's the only information they gave, was most of this intro was cut.
And again, no idea why?
Nope. Maybe to discourage kids from sticking gum on places that gum doesn't go?
Huh. Well, as you said, this is the UK spot.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a song by Gonzo called Down Memory Lane. And it begins with Rolf in the background of the shot at his piano. Gonzo walks forward to occupy the right half of the screen, very much in the foreground of the shot.
Mm-hmm.
And he sings directly to camera, except in that weird, not central position.
Yeah.
The joke of the lyrics is, I'm strolling down memory lane without a single thing to remember. And after a couple of variations on the concept of memory lane being given some kind of ironic reality, he then puts himself in a strange marching position, deliberately turning sideways to the camera, and marches off camera in order to then reappear in a time loop, a dimensional portal.
Ben, as we've talked about many, many times in this series,
yeah,
the Muppet Theater is a Real House of Leaves situation.
So after being able to walk off screen right, he then reappears on screen left in a loop, making Rolf very confused as to how this happened.
The 16 and a half foot hallway, Ben.
He does this again and then reappears again on the left-hand side of the screen, but this time he pushes Rolf's piano to the right side of the screen and then finishes the song in mirror image position of where he was.
Mm-hmm. And then after he finishes, pushes Rolf the rest of the way off stage. It was weird. I didn't love the song, could not tell you anything about the song, but visually that was fun.
I agree completely.
What I don't have in my statistics for this episode, because traditionally the UK spot is a 2-minute spot.
Correct.
The song is 1.53 minutes.
Okay.
I feel like that intro was longer than 30 seconds.
Mm.
So I think this UK spot was longer. But because the introduction wasn't music, I didn't time it. But yeah, it was fun.
And I believe this is also a Burroughs song.
Yes, the third of this episode. The third in a row. That might be a record in terms of... Because we've had other, as you said, artists yep, in the same episode. But I don't think we've had three in a row.
This one is not on the previous album, but is instead on the second album that came out that same year and is called The Girl with the Three Blue Eyes and Other Typical Type Songs. Which gives you an idea, those two titles in conjunction, as to a Burroughs sense of humor.
Mm.
And this is the first track on the album.
Wow.
So they thought that it was musically a strong thing to start on.
Yeah, and musically it sounded like other UK spots too. Maybe, again, since we haven't heard the original.
Piano-ness of it.
Yeah, but it matched. We then go to a sketch. Link Hogthrob is laying on a masseuse table,
mm-hmm,
doing push-ups, and then Peter Sellers enters dressed in a
white lab coat.
Yeah, which is weird. And
is that more or less weird than his Coke bottle glasses and little Hitler mustache?
Yeah. It's weirder because I don't picture masseuses wearing that lab coat, but less weird than doing a German-Austrian accent with that mustache.
Yeah, there's a reason why I wrote a trivia question about maybe Peter might have played multiple Hitlers in one movie. I'm pretty sure it's a thing that he's come back to multiple times.
Yeah. So who knows what that content warning at the beginning of this episode was, whether it was for the Romani sensitivity or...
Almost certainly.
Or a Hitler mustache. Maybe both.
He says he's your masseur, as you said, and he's here to loosen up the muscles on your naughty little body. And he does this by working his way down Link's legs, which are thoroughly untroubled by any kind of stuffing.
Mm-hmm.
They look very much empty. When Gonzo was being manipulated by John Cleese through the art of Dao Tu Chinghua,
yeah.
Gonzo's arms are stick puppet arms. They're kind of loose anyway, and to have them being pulled out of his body and have them been loose and floppy made a certain amount of sense. And it also makes practical sense that as Peter Sellers takes Link's legs and wraps them around a dumbbell,
mm-hmm.
you can't have them have be that thick or else that maneuver won't work.
Yeah.
But the image
and similarly later tying them up,
yep.
they wouldn't tie if there was stuffing in them.
But it does look, to my estimation, dumb. In that Link's lying out on the table, they don't look like legs. They look like somebody forgot to make them look like legs.
For someone who has the last name Hogthrob, his legs are not very desirous. he's got pretty bad calves.
No, Pete, he's not a calf. He's a pig.
Pretty bad hogs.
So, yeah, this is clearly being done for the bit.
Yeah.
But that's what the bit is that Sellers is going to keep up potentially improvised patter while he wraps the legs up in the dumbbell, and Link is supposed to be reacting in pain to this, but he's not really reacting that much at all.
He's reacting in that pleasure pain thing that people regularly do in a massage, where it's like, oh, that hurts, but it also feels good. But he's not, you're right, he's not reacting that strongly to any of it, just that slight...
The comparison that Sellers masseuse makes, masseur probably, he says,
tell me, Link, if you can feel that the blood is flowing easier this day. Oh, it's dead.
It has the sort of squeezing the toothpaste out of the tube vibe to it,
mm-hmm.
except there's no flab in the legs.
Yep. This is also, I just want to note, the same spa set that Rudolf Nureyev was accosted by Piggy on.
Ah!
It's the same steam room, bathhouse, double doors. You know what? This is also probably, now that I think about it, a version of the vet's hospital.
Almost certainly.
Because that, I think that's
the same. Those are the doors.
Those are the doors, and I think they have that green stripe.
So they've just removed all the medical equipment set dressing.
Yeah, and built a pool.
Well, they need to have some sort of a half wall in order for the bumps to hide behind it. As you mentioned, he stretches Link's legs one at a time back over his back to the front of his body, and then ties both his arms and his legs together, and Link ends up in a Gordian knot in the middle of the massage table.
I think they missed, because Peter Sellers is playing a German-Austrian character, I think they missed an opportunity to make a Bavarian pretzel joke.
And he then leaves, and Link is helpless and immobile, which is then immediately belied by the next backstage segment, where Link is able to walk himself from backstage.
Well, you hear him crying for help.
Mm.
The sketch ends with him in the knot crying for help. Cuts to backstage. You can hear him farther away say it two or three more times.
Was that supposed to end that way?
I don't think so.
And I think that's we talk a lot about the reality of the segments. Sometimes there's an illusion of everybody's playing a part.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's the awareness that our guests are not necessarily sufficiently prepared for what's going to happen on stage. for example, speaking of Rudolf Nureyev, I'd say it's probably Rudolf was playing a character in Baby It's Cold Outside.
Yes, of course.
But he did seem genuinely surprised by the Swine Princess.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reality of, is this a character or is this Rudolf doing something that he wasn't ready for on The Muppet Show, that reality goes back and forth. Similarly here, Peter Sellers playing the masseuse character, that's probably just a bit. And it was also, would have been just a bit if Link just left from being on stage. But that he continues to cry help and then walks himself off stage means they're trying to play it both ways.
Because while Link is calling for help before he walks on stage, Kermit and Fozzie are wondering if the sketch was supposed to end that way.
Again, bringing home the bacon of the idea of
ho-ho,
what is real on this show and what is people just playing fast and loose with liability issues and health and safety concerns.
Kermit asks Fozzie to check on the next act, and that's when Link walks in, says that that's the best massage he's ever had, that Peter O'Toole sure is good.
Peter O'Toole and Peter Sellers appeared in What's New Pussycat with Woody Allen and Ursula Andress and a number of other played people. So that actually is a thing that somebody might have gotten confused about, even though they look nothing alike.
Link leaves, and Beaker once again bloops into existence, startling Kermit again. Kermit screams, which scares Beaker. This is when Beaker is holding something, throws it into the air, bloops out of existence while it's still in the air on screen, and it falls to the ground. Parts of this were edited out of Nickelodeon.
Which parts?
Link walking backstage and Beaker suddenly appearing.
Huh.
So this is another disappearing moment cut from Nickelodeon.
Specifically, though, the two Beaker disappearing things. We had Gonzo and we had Peter disappearing. That was left okay. So it seems like Beaker is one of the problems.
Yeah, you're right.
Kermit definitely has reached a fever pitch of confusion and distress at this point. Then Fozzie yells from off stage and comes on screen telling him that their next act just canceled. Kermit says, but wait, that was a terrific act. That was Prunella and her prancing poultry. And Fozzie goes into a very melodramatic, over-the-top thing saying, yes, but you see, Kermit, yesterday, duck season began. Kermit then says he's going to go explain what's been going on to the audience and exits screen right. And Fozzie looks after him like he's about to say something.
Mm.
But instead, they cut to Kermit in front of the curtain, stammering and saying, I don't know how to tell you this, but the next act can't make it. And as he's explaining this, and that there's nothing else to replace it, the curtains open behind him on an undressed stage.
Mm-hmm. Which is weird that that would happen.
And that's why I think there's a very strange tone here, in that this is supposed to be a build-up to Kermit having been so overwhelmed by the show not going well that he has this vulnerable moment and sings It's Not Easy Being Green.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't want the previous sketch backstage segment to end with Fozzie making a joke, but the way in which Fozzie looks at Kermit going off stage makes it seem as if this is Fozzie's plan. The curtain opening makes it seem like, based on that look and based on the way in which he's melodramatically come in and told Kermit that things have gone even more wrong, that Fozzie is the person opening the curtains and manipulating him into performing this. But there's no dialogue. It feels like there was a line that was cut. Because why would Fozzie be doing this?
Yeah.
That is a whole dynamic that would be very bizarre. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make my boss so stressed out that he does this beautiful performance.
Yeah, that he does this iconic moment that people point to as being one of the most beautiful and memorable moments in Muppet Show history.
Yeah, would be a very deeply odd manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
But equally deeply odd is that this feels like a closer to the show and happens just after halfway through.
18 minutes in is when the song starts, so 2/3 through.
And so the idea that this takes place And then there's more after that where they have to deal with the dangling thread of the teleportation. Structurally is very bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't really have to talk about this all that much because everyone has seen this.
But let's talk about one aspect to it.
Fair.
Which is that Kermit starts by singing this by seating on a crate
mm-hmm.
on an empty stage. And then as he performs the song, the backdrop of trees comes down behind him. But then as the camera cuts, he is no longer on a stage, on a box. He is on a stump in a real forest.
Yep.
And as the final camera pans back away, we are not in the Muppet Theater at all. This has been a magical transformation.
Yep. It was interesting, but not interesting. And if it wasn't such an iconic Muppet moment, I would probably be more critical of it. Because I was like, that's what they're doing with this song. It's just a camera pan up and then a camera pan right and then
a zoom back.
Yeah, subtly changing the stage. It is effective. The transition into Kermit being in a forest is really well done.
And it's not something we would generally attribute to Peter Harris.
No.
But he's the one who does it.
Indeed. This is a Peter episode. So yeah, it's being green.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's great. Where I want to be.
Okay. You want to be in the forest?
That's the lyrics. Yes. I know, Ben. It's iconic. Take a shot.
Well, after Kermit's done being green, which he'll never be done being green, we go to Muppet Labs to find out maybe what's been happening this episode. Because Bunsen reveals that they've been testing the new Muppet Labs teleporter, and it works perfectly.
Kermit rushes on saying, aha, that's what's been happening around here. You've been zapping people.
While he is carrying on with all these details, Bunsen subtly guides him into the machine and then presses a button to bloop him away.
So that he can, in an uninterrupted way, discuss this. He says that he has sent Beaker out previously to Africa and he's going to bring him back. And when he does, Beaker shows up in the clutches of a Muppet ape.
Gorilla. Apparently a gorilla named Quango, according to the Wikia.
Bunsen's dialogue here is fantastic. He says, Beaker, put that gorilla back. You don't know where he's been. And so he ports him back in order to have Beaker get rid of the gorilla. And then when he brings them back, it's not Beaker, it's Kermit and the gorilla.
The gorilla is jumping all over Kermit. Kermit is shouting at Bunsen. Bunsen outros the segment by saying, and that's all from Muppet Labs. And we cut to the red curtain.
Where Fozzie is, because Kermit is definitely wrapped up in this. And also there is this weird aspect of Fozzie being the power behind the manipulative throne.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that he's going to make this introduction. And then he's interrupted by Sellers. He's continuing his Richard III bit by doing, now is the winter of our discontent.
Fozzie tells him that he's supposed to be in costume, getting ready for the next act.
And I will point out, he is wearing the vest and pants and top that he wears in the next sketch. So he is very close to being in costume. What he doesn't have is his makeup and his hat.
Yeah, and specifically the spirit-gummed full beard and mustache. That's going to take longer than 5 seconds to put on. The hat, I'd give you. If he came out sans hat, but with facial hair, I'd be like, yes, he's ready to go.
Even then, Fozzie's line shouldn't be, you're not in costume. It should be,
you're not in makeup. Fair.
He then says, by the way, Peter, the show is running long, so try to be short. And so Peter exits the sketch by dropping down on his knees, again, using the stage below the camera, which he actually can access, unlike the Muppets and the gum. And he does a Dorf-esque walk off screen.
I use the same reference. Also, Ben, the show's running a little long. We should wrap it up.
Okay.
It's not actually. We're right on usual schedule.
Fozzie says he takes things so literally, a bit that hasn't been established at all prior to this, but is delivered with that kind of writing as if this is the culmination or continuation of a thing. Anyway, here's the incredible Peter Sellers.
Ben?
Yeah.
The last part of this introduction, cut from Nickelodeon. I assume from the show's running long bit on.
Huh.
And then probably just, ladies and gentlemen, the incredible Peter Sellers.
This is a performance of the song Cigarettes and Whiskey, variably Cigarettes and Whiskey and Wild Wild Women. Lots of different variations on how the title is published. It was written by Tim Spencer in 1946 and seems to have been part of the repertoire of the cowboy group Sons of the Pioneers. But it was also seems to have been the inspiration for a 1957 French sex farce because it shares the same title.
Okay.
Another thing that uses the title is the poet Anne Sexton used it as the title of a poem she wrote in 74 that was published in her posthumous 1976 collection, 45 Mercy Street. The poem is titled Cigarettes and Whiskey and Wild Wild Woman, small print from the song lyrics.
Huh, interesting.
The most potential mainstream version of this that I was able to find is that Jim Croce re-recorded it in 2003.
Wow, that is recent.
The comic premise of this is that they are part of the Salvation Army. Despite looking like the Amish,
yeah,
they are marching for salvation because Peter is banging a giant bass drum. And at key points in the song, he bangs the drum so loudly that a bearded Dr. Strangepork, who is helping to fill out the cast, and Grandpa from the jug band all jump in alarm in time with the drum beats.
This song has ruined me.
I look forward to a further explanation of that statement.
Since listening to the song twice, it is now hard for me currently to say or think the word cigarettes properly. After 39 years of using that word somewhat frequently since my mother was a smoker, I now have to think, I'm currently thinking cigarettes, and then going, no, that's wrong, it's cigarettes. Because cigarettes is so fun to say.
As the fandom page states, one of the ways in which this is variously titled, they say it can be spelled phonetically with cigarettes and whiskey with a U in the middle. Has that been contagious as part of your vocabulary?
Nope. Cigarettes. Might have broken me.
We'll see.
Ben?
Yeah?
This also is my favorite sketch of the entire season so far.
The entire I thought when you started that sentence, I was like, yeah, it makes sense that this is your favorite sketch of the episode. Season?
Yeah. You know why?
I do, actually.
Now you do, that I phrase it that way.
Yes, because we have a reappearance of George the Janitor in full jacket with his name on the back.
I'm doing a dance, audience. You can't see it. I'm pumping my arms in the air. However, he's not pogoing.
No, he really isn't.
Was very upset about that.
Which is why I assumed you would be enthusiastic, but not quite this enthusiastic.
Hey, I'm just happy to see my best friend George.
And he does shout in character voice. Mm-hmm. Unlike when he was in the wildlife shooting sketch, he gives his line about shooting a motorcycle, and it doesn't really sound like George, even though it was performed by Frank, as far as we can tell. This, however, is full on at the dance George vocalization, where he goes, yeah!
My very good friend, it's so nice to see him.
Cigarettes and whiskey and wild, wild women, they'll drive you crazy, they'll drive you insane.
So yes, that is a bit hyperbolic on my part. It's not realistically my favorite sketch of the season. But it's my favorite sketch of the season.
George only shows up for the final chorus.
Yeah.
Prior to that point, how was the jokes of this sketch?
Cigarettes broke me, and I enjoyed that Peter was actually playing the drum. And so when in the trivia, when you said he actually played the drums, unless you made that up.
Nope, that part was real.
I, in my brain, went, oh, okay, that makes sense. Because, yeah, it's definitely live recording on this, too. So, yeah, it was fun.
I mean, we want it to be fun because I don't want to work. I just want to bang on the drum all day.
It's true. It's true.
At the conclusion of that sketch, we cut back to the curtain for the final farewells. Kermit comes out to say that we want to thank our special guest star, Mr. Peter Sellers, who then whoops in. Kermit says, oh, there you are. And then he instantly disappears. Kermit says, were. And then as he zoops back in, he says, am, before disappearing again.
He does also say in that moment, well, thank you very much indeed. Mm. That was my theory of maybe that was Peter Sellers.
Yeah. And
because when he comes back and says, am, he's wearing the German helmet or the military helmet.
Yeah.
And he's definitely doing a voice, which I assume must be a character from something else, like that he's done before.
Yeah, I don't know. It didn't ring a bell to me, and it certainly wasn't sourced in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
It was just straight to, as far as I could tell, him channeling the German from Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In.
Yeah, same.
Upon which he appeared three times. In fact, famously, he does a German voice and impression with that character on Laugh-In. They do a duo where they each try to out-German soldier each other.
Interesting. So maybe it is that.
Prior to that point, I don't have any reference as to Peter playing a German soldier in anything else. So if that is part of his filmic repertoire, it's unknown to me.
Then the rest of the Muppets from the episode bloop into existence, and we go to credits.
We cut to credits, and at the end of the credits, Statler and Waldorf are there, and Statler asks, so what do you think?
And before Waldorf can answer, he bloops out of existence.
Again, this felt less like Bunsen continuing to randomly teleport people, and more like an act of Waldorf saying, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
That his answer to the question is, what I think of the show is, I don't want to be here anymore. Much like Peter being saying, I'm no longer going to be in the same room as this bomb. Because then Statler says, yeah, I know what you, and then also bloops out of existence. Therefore expressing the same sentiment of, I also don't want to be here.
Yeah, but I think that's also, you can take that as coincidental too, because
he doesn't finish the sentence.
He doesn't finish the sentence, and Waldorf, if he didn't disappear, he would have said something negative.
Mm.
Like, it is a nice hat to the episode, but if it didn't happen, he would have said something.
Well, I want to hear statistics, but I'm also very intrigued about a guest star who's known for doing bits and voices and characters, almost pathologically so. And whether or not that falls under your definition of he's just doing his shtick. So let's hear some statistics and let's hear some rankings.
There aren't many statistics for this episode.
Aren't.
I clocked no hits because the only potential hit is when Peter drops the barbell, the dumbbell on Link's leg. But he drops it over the leg.
And says, I almost got you there.
Yeah. So it's not a hit. There's the bomb explosion, no human Muppet kisses. I didn't notice any of the other things.
No.
I don't think there was a will you get out of here.
No, I don't believe so either.
Which, Kermit was mad enough that it easily could have happened this episode.
Except that one of the things that made him mad
was people getting out of there before he could say it. Very good point. There was 11.71 minutes of music out of 26.47 minutes of show for 44.24%, which is solidly middle of the road.
I was going to guess we have a new loser in the clubhouse.
Similar to the Julie Andrews from last week, when there was music, it was over 2 minutes long.
Okay.
With the exception of the UK spot and Rolf, the When song. But the opening song was almost 2.5 minutes. Being Green was
long.
2 1/3.
Yep.
And Cigarettes and Whiskey was 2 3/4.
Really?
Yeah.
I would not have pegged that as the longest song of the show.
And I actually cut it a little bit because the opening segment, the Romani song, there's a little bit of a musical sting and then it kind of goes away.
Mm.
And so I didn't include that. But in Cigarettes and Whiskey, there was a little bit of an undercurrent at the very beginning of undertone music. Which I did include. So, yeah. Medium. Not low, not high.
That was nice of you, Pete, to use medium instead of fortune teller, because that also would have been offensive to the Romani.
Yes. So, Ben, sometimes I like to ask you to guess where I put someone. So, Ben, what's your thoughts on where would I put Peter Sellers?
I think that he would have been low middle. Because he's doing stuff, and it's neither successful nor aggressively annoying. You liked one of the songs. The other one had business in it, but was also not great. I think he might have split the difference and been out of 24, mm-hmm. 13 or 14.
Ben? Number one, baby.
Apparently, I'm just reading you wrong all the time now. I have completely lost any sort of read on how you are responding to these episodes. I was so wrong about number 24, and now I have been equally wrong about your new fave.
Ben, my fave is problematic.
Yeah, it is. Well, congratulations on embodying that meme to an extreme.
Yeah, everything he did I found enjoyable. Your instinct of he doesn't really connect with the Muppets is kind of true. He doesn't have that emotional grasp to it. Mm-hmm. But he's having a blast, and I had a blast.
Huh.
And even though the Romani segment isn't great,
he's still fun in it.
He commits to it. Mm. He's having a blast. It was fun. So I have very few complaints.
I wonder if, as we finish up the season, or if you have time to think about this, you might regret this.
We'll find out. But since we're talking about it,
yeah,
let me jump straight into moments.
Yeah.
Because one of my moments is a Peter Sellers moment that we haven't talked about. Mm. So for our first moment, my first moment, in Cigarettes and Whiskey, when he first starts singing, he has a look on his face as he's using that voice that seems like he's surprising himself with the voice.
It's a very strange voice.
He starts doing the voice and he, like, his eyes, like, light up. And he's doing that thing that improvisers sometimes do when they
discover something.
Yeah. And then he settles into it and is consistent the rest of the time.
Hey, preachman, dear friend, you're about to receive on John Barleycorn nicotine and the temptations of Eve.
Oh, yeah!
Well, if it's so good, let's hear it!
You will, brother, you will.
But that look in his eyes, I was just like, oh, that's fun. And I think that's another reason why he got shot up in the rankings, because I was like, he's having a blast.
For our second moment, my first moment, I'm going to talk about Gonzo's performance in the UK spot. Because Gonzo in this season has developed his own wide-eyed fanaticism. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Peter Sellers being surprised at something, I can picture Gonzo having a very similar wide-eyed expression. He does not at all during this episode. He's not playing that vibe at all. Mm-hmm. And yet, his commitment to the bit in this sketch is extraordinary. The way in which he artificially throws out his arm in order to strike a pose during a moment in the musicality, and the way in which he pivots and stops in order to do his weird dimensional House of Leaves march. He's doing it not in that kind of wide-eyed crazed surprise that he's generated it, but instead in a total fierce, I am doing this way, but without the amazement. And I think the business that he does in terms of the walk and the pushing of the piano is so weird and so much fun. I just wanted to re-highlight it, that they had to come up with something to do. They chose this song, they wanted to do something with it, and they're like, what do we do with it? I can't figure out what they're channeling with this decision-making process. It doesn't make any sense, but I also don't care, mm-hmm. because I love this bit. The person who is surprised by this bit is Rolf.
Yeah.
But Gonzo is not. And I want to applaud his absolute dedication to what he's doing.
For my second moment, our third moment, our middle moment, I also want to talk about Gonzo. Mm. I have four words. But it died, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
End of moment. Drop it in here, Ben.
Died, Peter!
That's all that needs to be said.
Yeah. It was on my short list of options as well. It's really good.
Also honorable mention too, and cut this out if you want to use it, Gonzo are riding a motorcycle. It's both a full-bodied Muppet and a silly joke in one moment.
No, I'm confident that my second moment, our fourth moment, does not need to be another Gonzo moment. Although I think, to me, Gonzo is the MVP of this episode, even though you clearly think Peter is. You mentioned this already, but I want to highlight how much fun I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
Which was the chickens eating the feed out of Peter Sellers' hand.
Now, Peter, I
enjoy a good chicken.
Yes, that act is really wonderful.
The fact that they took the time to do that, to give this additional recurrence. First of all, the chickens squawking as bagpipes under his arms was a weird enough thing. But then to give them the additional reality of, and they don't make the joke, we pay them in chicken feed.
No, yeah.
They don't go for the obvious joke. It's just instead they lean into the reality of, if this was a live animal on set that we would need to then trick with food after it's performed a stunt,
mm-hmm.
you would immediately have treats on hand. And the fact that Peter Sellers immediately has treats on hand for these chickens is a great bit of blurring that line between Muppet and what the Muppets represent
mm-hmm.
that we often don't do on the show. We're just like, oh yeah, those are Muppet chickens. They can sometimes talk and sometimes not. In order to be on camera, are mysteriously floating 3 feet off the ground. There are lots of things that the show ignores for the purposes of expediency. And I always love it when they re-clue into the reality of a situation. And that was both cute and fun and real.
Yeah.
If you can have three things be a both.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, it's not directly related, but once more, I'd just like to mention Toon Chickens, once more into the breach. That beforehand really got me. I had three potential moments from that, like, 40 seconds. For my final moment, our fifth moment, our final moment, there's something we didn't mention that I'd be remiss if we didn't mention.
Mm.
And that's in the Romani sketch.
Oh, hang on.
Yeah.
Is this the weird Irish silent boy?
No.
Okay.
Also good, though. But Ben...
because that kid creeped me out.
Yeah. No, it was... it's good.
It's bad.
Yeah.
It's some of the worst puppeteering we've seen on this show.
Well, I think it's another one of those cases of... they needed a puppet, but that boy never moves. It's not a puppet. It's a doll.
Well, he moves, but he's not... his mouth doesn't
yeah.
move. And also, there's a similar shot of two puppets sitting to the left of the center that are very clearly being controlled with the least amount of animation possible, because I think there were too many Muppets and not enough arms in this sketch.
Yeah, there's three on each side.
Yeah.
No, that's not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
There was a live goat on that stage.
Yes! And the reveal of it is very weird, because we start off with Peter on the stairs of the wagon, holding his violin and talking to the audience, and you can't see the goat. And it's only when it then cuts to a wide shot and you see it. And my first reaction was, wait, has that been there the whole time?
Yeah. For the second episode in a row, we've got live animals on stage. We had the cow last week. Mm-hmm. We got a goat this week. We can't not mention the goat, Ben.
It's true. We almost went the whole episode without mentioning the goat.
I was so happy when you glossed over it. When you didn't mention it, I was like, yep, that's a moment for me now. Also, the Muppet that's playing the tambourine is excellent.
Mm.
Because that it was actually playing the tambourine. But that's overshadowed by a goat.
Very difficult for a goat not to overshadow things. As much as this is the Muppet Show, I think we have now, for three occasions on this season, been really the stars of this show, our farmyard animals.
Ben, farmyard animals are the true goats of the Muppet Show. You're mad that's going to have to be the last line of this episode, aren't you?
I'm impressed with how glad you are that after a couple of episodes of not having a good last line, you finally landed on one that is simultaneously a winner and a loser.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cohen's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at firstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @firstnamebasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in the podcast are used for purposes of review. There are things, dates, facts, names, cultural depictions, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben,
whoop,
and we'll see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 15, guest starring Lou Rawls. Yay!